Most of the time, we can take breathing for granted. It just happens unless we stop it, which is a good idea while swimming underwater, for example. The rest of the time, what goes in and out of your lungs does not take much thought. So when we do give it some thought, it's pretty fascinating. Not just the composition of the atmosphere, but what composed it, and the fact that the molecules we breathe in were assuredly in someone else's lungs in the past. Sam Keen runs with all of this in his book, Caesar's Last Breath, Decoding the Secrets of the Air Around Us. Sam Keen has a lot of fun with science, and he shares that sense of fun in his books. He already visited the exchange to talk about two previous books, The Disappearing Spoon, turns out gallium melts at 84 degrees, and The Violinist's Thumb. If Sam's voice sounds familiar, he's also been in NPR's Radio Lab, All Things Considered, and Fresh Air. Sam Keen, good to have you back on the exchange.
Hi, thanks for having me back.
Good to have you. So, heck of a way to start. We're inhaling secondhand breath all the time?
Yeah, we are. It's sort of an inescapable fact of the way the atmosphere works and the fact that a lot of the molecules we breathe, especially the nitrogen molecules, are very hardy molecules. They last for millions, even billions of years. So, yeah, we're constantly recycling the breath of everyone around us, which can be a good thing. It can connect you with people in the past, your loved ones, your heroes from the past, but, you know, it connects you with people you might not want to be connected with at the same time.
But, you know, I'm sure the first reaction of a lot of people, okay, it was my first reaction, it was like, oh, come on. I mean, the molecules from Caesar's last breath, really?
Yeah, it seems like it would be impossible. That happened so long ago, over 2,000 years now, and a breath just seems so tiny compared to the giganticness of the entire atmosphere that you'd think, you know, there's no way. That has to be just completely effaced and eroded at this point. But actually, you inhale so many molecules every time you breathe, something like 25 sextillion molecules. So that's a 25 with 21 zeros after it. You just inhale so many of them that they last for a long time. And if you do the math, you work everything out, it turns out that statistically, you're probably breathing in one molecule or so that Caesar exhaled during his last breath every single time you breathe. So thousands of times a day, you had this direct material connection with Julius Caesar.
Or anybody else that you either like or don't, for that matter.
Yeah, exactly. Anyone in history that you can think of, or even any animals in history, things like that, you have this direct connection with them just because of the way the air and our breath works.
So, you know, one of the great things about this book is that it makes us really think about not just what we're breathing now, but how the solar system formed in the first place. And you say the story of Earth is the story of its gases. Explain that, please.
Yeah, so if you look at what you inhale every time, obviously a lot of nitrogen, a lot of oxygen, those are the big gases, but there are all sorts of other trace gases as well. And if you look at all of those gases in total, some of them come from the very early days of planet Earth. Some of them come about only with the rise of life on Earth. Some of them come about only with the rise of complex life. And then some of them are very new. They only come about with human civilizations. And in fact, if you look at all these gases, you can basically reconstruct a whole history of the world every single time you take a breath, just by looking at the gases and the stories that they carry with them. And, you know, you can, yeah, again, you can reconstruct everything about the Earth. And not only that, but I think gases play a bigger role in our lives, in our civilizations, than people might appreciate. Not only shaping our biology, but shaping a lot of other things about medicine, about industry, about all sorts of things that really make human beings what they are today.
But even beyond that, I mean, the fact that when you think about the bodies in the solar system, including the one we ride around on, is condensed gas. Is that really is that simple?
Yeah, basically what happened was there was, you know, gas floating around in space, this very loose cloud of molecules. Eventually it came together, coalesced into something solid, and formed our Earth. So Earth came from gases originally, and, you know, billions of years from now, it will return to gases. So everything around you, your own body, you know, the desk in front of you, your computer, your phone, all of that stuff used to be gases way back when. It had to condense down, become solid matter, but it was a gas that will return to a gas someday.
You know, one of the things that is a feature of any Sam Keen book is the great stories that are told as illustrating science. And there's quite a riff in here on Harry Truman. Which Harry Truman and why?
Yeah, the other Harry Truman is probably famous around that area. When Mount St. Helens was going to blow in the early 1980s, they basically evacuated everyone they could off the mountain except for a few people, including this Harry Truman, who refused to leave the mountain. He claimed that all of the threats were overblown and that the mountain really wasn't going to explode and that he was determined to stay there. And he became sort of a famous kind of a media celebrity. He had this very colorful background in that, you know, he'd been a rum runner during Prohibition, a bootlegger, and he kind of ran off into the mountains around Mount St. Helens to get away from gangsters who wanted to kill him. He eventually ended up opening a campground there, and he ran it with one of his wives, the third wife, who ended up being the love of his life, and really enjoyed the area. And unfortunately for him, she ended up dying a few years before Mount St. Helens blew, and he was very sad about this, very depressed. So when all the Mount St. Helens hoopla started, he basically decided he wasn't going to leave.
And so he got vaporized by the volcano, and you describe in rather detailed terms what probably happens when you get a human body in contact with superheated gas and volcanic ash and all that stuff, which we won't go into right now, but it leads us to a discussion of the things that come from volcanoes, including the formation of our atmosphere. That'll get explained in the next segment of the program as we talk more with Sam Keen about his book Caesar's Last Breath, Decoding the Secrets of the Air Around Us. Back on the Jefferson Exchange with Sam and with your phone calls and emails in a minute 15. Back on the Jefferson Exchange on the News and Information Service of Jefferson Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Our guest today is Sam Keen, a science writer extraordinaire. We've had him on before talking about the disappearing spoon and the violinist's thumb. Now he's getting all the way into our lungs with a book about the air we breathe. It's called Caesar's Last Breath, Decoding the Secrets of the Air Around Us. You can join the conversation on the Exchange as we explore not just what gets into our lungs, but how those things get into our atmosphere in the first place. Join us by phone at 800-838-3760, by email jx@jeffnet.org. So, we were just talking about... Whoops, we seem to have lost Sam Keen. We're going to hang up that phone and we'll I'll riff a little longer and we can get Sam back on the line. This is the Jefferson Exchange on Jefferson Public Radio. Sam Keen, again, the author of the book Caesar's Last Breath, Decoding the Secrets of the Air Around Us. Sam has made it clear that that we actually could be breathing in molecules that were in the lungs of Julius Caesar and any other famous creature in history, for that matter, just because of the fact that molecules are not destroyed over time. And what was the number? 25 sextillion molecules of air get into our lungs every time we breathe. So that's a lot of molecules to move around. And Sam is back on the line with us now. So, Sam, the question was about, we were talking about Harry Truman and the volcano that killed him, Mount St. Helens.
Yep.
But volcanoes had a lot to do with forming the atmosphere that we breathe now?
Yeah, volcanoes actually were the basis of the first real atmosphere that Earth had. So if you look back, you know, to the early days, billions of years ago, all of the gas in the air was basically shooting up from volcanoes. And it eventually added a lot of the gases that we breathe today that we associate with the atmosphere. It eventually has changed over time, but even the nitrogen in the air, kind of the major constituent of the air, a lot of it originally came from volcanoes. So they're still shaping the air that we breathe today, even though we think about them as sort of, you know, the gases coming out of volcanoes are usually pretty nasty stuff, but eventually over time they did shape what we breathe.
But at some point in the book, you start making our heads hurt when you talk about making air, because it turns out Earth had earlier atmospheres, and you start to count them as you go along. How many have there been?
There have been roughly, you know, it depends a little bit on how you count, but roughly four different atmospheres over time. A very early one that was just some hydrogen and helium, kind of a comb-over atmosphere, very wispy, that blew away pretty quickly. Then there was a second atmosphere, the one I mentioned with all the hot, nasty volcanic gases. that gave way over a long time, a few billion years, to a nitrogen-dominant one. And then eventually we got something like the atmosphere of today, where you have oxygen in the mix. But one kind of interesting fact about all that, I don't think a lot of people know, is that oxygen was kind of a latecomer onto the scene. And in fact, life arose on Earth well before there was any oxygen in the air. And in fact, oxygen was poisonous to most forms of life that ever existed. It would actually kill most organisms. So this thing we think about as vital to life, the very stuff of life in some ways, oxygen, was actually a poison for most creatures who've ever existed on Earth.
So how did it get so important? What was it that that made creatures adapt to oxygen, or at least not be killed by it?
Well, it was kind of necessity. It was either adapt or die. It was the basic situation they faced. The problem with oxygen for these creatures was that oxygen is very powerful, a very, very reactive gas, and it was just too powerful for them. They couldn't handle it. They didn't have sort of the sophisticated cellular machinery that we have nowadays, and they had to adapt that. They had to evolve it over time. Took quite a while for this to happen, but eventually some of our microbial ancestors figured out how to contain oxygen, how to control it, how to harness it. I kind of compare it in the book to the plutonium in a nuclear power plant, in that, you know, it's very powerful stuff. You can do a lot with plutonium, but you have to keep the plutonium very carefully confined. You have to control the plutonium. The same way with oxygen. It's a very powerful substance. It's what makes animals, complex animals like those, possible. But you do have to keep control on it, or it ends up being a poison.
Well, and as you point out, I mean, most of the air is nitrogen. Oxygen is just 21% of the air around us. I mean, what is it that makes it so important?
Well, basically, it's what gives us, it allows us to perform certain reactions in our cells that store energy, that liberate energy. We need oxygen because nitrogen, even though it's very common, is a very unreactive gas. It's very placid. It just doesn't do much in the air, whereas oxygen is a very active gas. So we just need the energy that's in oxygen to metabolize things, to live.
Is it a catalyst? Is it sort of along that line? It makes other things work better?
It's not a catalyst. What a catalyst does is a catalyst is involved in the reaction in some way, but a catalyst itself doesn't change. It just speeds a reaction, whereas oxygen is actually going in and participating in the reaction. What it basically does is it goes in there and starts ripping electrons off things, and then that kicks off a series of other reactions. So oxygen is very good about sort of instigating these things by shuttling electrons around.
Sam Keen, our guest on the Jefferson Exchange, his latest book, Caesar's Last Breath, Decoding the Secrets of the Air Around Us. So it occurs to me that if you need oxygen to have a lot of things work well and work better, this is probably why oxyacetylene torches have the oxy part.
Yes, exactly. You need the oxygen to sort of, kick things off, get the chemical processes going. And actually, in the book, I talk a little bit about, we think about oxygen, or oxygen in that context with the torches is burning, and we think about oxygen as breathing as well. And there was a time there where people were sort of figuring out that, maybe oxygen that breathing is sort of this slow burning process inside of us, and that gave credence to a lot of old hoary theories about things like spontaneous combustion, you know, people just going up in flames for no reason. And people were using these scientific discoveries about breathing and burning and relating them to these old legends about spontaneous combustion. So you see kind of this odd mix of this weird legendary pseudoscience and some very sophisticated good science back in the 1800s.
Well, and the good science involved a great story about some guy who tried to cut his way into a German bank in 1890. What was he doing?
Well, he was trying to get the money out of the bank is basically what he was trying to do. This was maybe one of the most, or the first real scientific crimes, in that he was using a very high-end technology. He was using these torches to try to break into a bank vault. And this was a time when torches were a very new technology. And he would have been a very sophisticated person to be so in tune with the scientific scene, where he realized that he could take these torches and break into a bank vault, or try to break into a bank vault. He had a little bit of trouble there, as it explains in the book.
Well, but one of the things you point out, though, is the process of oxygen being applied at the heat and pressure, which is being applied to metal, is, you think of it as burning through, but it's actually a different kind of process.
Yeah, there are a few different things going on. Sometimes metals do burn in that, you know, there's a certain chemical process called burning where they combine with oxygen. But other times what torches are actually doing is they're actually sort of speed melting it in a way. So different reactions can go on depending on what type of torch it is, what the goal is, things like that.
All right, so it's actually kind of rusting its way through the metal?
Yeah, it's sort of like this speed rusting process. So, you know, rust we usually think about is a very slow process, like a car. The body deteriorates over time, but in some cases, the very best torches actually do something very similar to rusting a metal, but on a very accelerated time scale. So you see almost instantaneous rusting, which is a much faster process than melting, or what we kind of normally think about.
Well, as long as we're talking about oxygen, what is the oxygen curse you mention in the book, Sam?
Well, there are a few people historically who are given credit for discovering oxygen. Carl Scheele, Joseph Priestley, and a Frenchman named Lavoisier. And unfortunately for them, all three of them came to rather awful ends. Scheele ended up accidentally poisoning himself in his lab one day and died rather painfully from that. Joseph Priestley ended up accidentally instigating a riot in his hometown in England. He got burned in effigy, his house got destroyed, and he got run off from England to the United States. And Lavoisier, the French scientist, actually came to the worst end of all because he got beheaded during the French Revolution. They marched him up on a stage, put him in the guillotine, and chopped his head off. So it didn't turn out well for any of these three scientists. So oxygen, there was a bit of a curse on all of those who discovered it.
Was there any reluctance among scientists to get involved with oxygen studies after what happened to the three of them?
No, not at all. Scientists are kind of foolhardy like that. It just seemed, it was so interesting. Like, you can't not want to know more about oxygen. So no hesitation whatsoever.
Sam Keen, the science writer, our guest once again on the Jefferson Exchange. His latest book is called Caesar's Last Breath, Decoding the Secrets of the Air Around Us. That's right. The air in your lungs could have actually been, at least some of the molecules, in the lungs of Julius Caesar in his last breath. You can join us on the Jefferson Exchange as we talk about the things that are in the air that we breathe without even thinking about, and get us to think about them just a bit more. 800-838-3760 if you want to join the conversation by phone. Email address is jx@jeffnet.org. Here's a call from Charlie and Eugene. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange.
I had a car once that I think suffered instantaneous rust. I actually wanted to, as you mentioned, Lavoisier, I actually wanted to bring up Lavoisier and the infamous, you mentioned how the unfortunate ending of poor Monsieur Lavoisier coming to the guillotine. But do you know about the experiment that they conducted with him and his science buddies at the guillotine?
I've heard of it. A legend. They're not sure if it really happened or not.
No, but there are drawings that exist. There are actually drawings that were made.
Of what? Charlie, tell the story.
Well, apparently, everybody was wondering, well, how long is the head sentient after it's removed from the body?
Uh-huh.
So they agreed to a little experiment, and Lavoisier was the head. Once the head was removed, head was placed there on the platform, and he proceeded to blink, the blinking indicating to his science buddies that he was still sentient, okay?
Uh-huh.
And apparently, whether legend or the account that I read, was that he blinked for 17 times.
Huh, okay, let's pick this up.
Yeah, it's kind of his final experiment. In some way. He was a scientist to the very, very end, even after the end.
So what did you find out yourself, though, Sam? It sounds like you've heard about this, but there's some question about the veracity of it all?
Yeah, you know, it's one of those stories that sounds great, but some people say, oh, no way it could have taken place. You know, they actually, he was in a kind of a group where they killed like 35 people or something. So it was a kind of a quick in and out for him. But, you know, other people insist that it happened. So it happened so long ago, it's a little hard to tell nowadays.
So let's go way back in time, now that we've talked about the oxygen curse and talk about what it's been doing on the Earth. How did oxygen first grow in abundance?
Basically, there were small microbes that were releasing it. As I mentioned, oxygen was a poison for them, so they wanted to expel it to get it out of them. They started releasing it into the water first, into the ocean, and then eventually it built up in the atmosphere. So basically, they were just trying to expel it to try to get rid of it.
Okay, so we had this poison in the air, though. So does this lead to what you refer to in the book as the oxygen catastrophe?
Yeah, eventually it built up enough where you had this gigantic mass extinction event where there was just so much of this poison in the air that it started destroying them. It would be similar today to someone releasing a bunch of chlorine into the air. You can imagine how much that would burn inside of our lungs. That was what happened to these microbes. And oxygen is actually a really interesting gas. As I said, not only was it poisonous for most creatures in Earth's history, but it's actually veered kind of up and down a lot over the past about 500 million years or so. You see it rise up, and then you see it crash and move all over the place. And when oxygen's at high levels in the air, it actually has really interesting effects on the evolution of certain creatures, especially insects. Because insects have this very inefficient breathing process. They don't have lungs in the same way that we do. So they have a lot of trouble getting oxygen into their interior cells deep inside them. That's actually the reason why insects are so small nowadays. If you've ever wondered why are insects almost always tiny, it's because of this inefficient breathing process, and oxygen can't get deep into their cells otherwise. But when oxygen levels are much higher, if they're, say, 35%, which they have been in the past, then suddenly insects can get much, much larger. And you see this in the fossil record because you see, you know, millipedes that are a yard long. You see spiders the size of seagulls. You see these gigantic, gigantic insects, all because the level of oxygen in the air had risen to a level where they could evolve and be larger. So even something simple as changing the concentration in the oxygen or in the air of oxygen can really have profound effects on the biology of creatures.
So, Sam, what caused those spurts?
It's really hard to say. Geologists don't really know. It might have been an overabundance of, say, microbes that were releasing it. Could have been related to other things like temperature or, you know, other geological events. It's a little hard to say, a little hard to reconstruct what exactly happened there.
Well, that leads us to our time then, and the balance between oxygen and carbon dioxide in the atmosphere. I mean, all discussion of us releasing CO2 in the atmosphere aside, what tends to keep it in balance?
Well, what used to keep it in balance for a long time was that carbon dioxide would dissolve into oceans or other bodies of water, and then eventually you would see it precipitate out. It would become a mineral or something. And over the long term, the ocean can basically scrub carbon dioxide out of the atmosphere. Unfortunately, though, that process takes millions of years. And human beings have dumped so much CO2 into the air in the past, especially century or so, that nice system has been overwhelmed. And so you start to see carbon dioxide build up very quickly in the atmosphere. So it's kind of thrown the atmosphere out of whack just because of how much got released so quickly.
We're clogging the machinery, in essence.
What's that?
We're clogging the machinery.
Clogging the machinery, yeah, just kind of overwhelming it, and the atmosphere just simply isn't able to keep up anymore.
So when we talk about things that are difficult to breathe, carbon dioxide obviously is one that humans don't handle very well. This brings us to another volcano story, other than Mount St. Helens, from a lake in Cameroon. What happened there?
Yeah, it's called Lake Nyos in Cameroon, and it had this very strange event in 1986. It's a crater lake, so it was up kind of elevated, and it was sitting in the hole, essentially, of an old volcano. And the volcano was kind of active in that it wasn't erupting, but it was releasing carbon dioxide. And eventually carbon dioxide, over a few centuries, started to build up the bottom of this lake. The weight of the water on top of it kept it confined for a very long time, but eventually, one unlucky day, all of the carbon dioxide whooshed up, it released, it went right up to the surface and made this gigantic fountain that basically started spreading around the area and killing all of the human beings and other animals there. So a very strange natural disaster.
Well, which raises the question for those of us who live 80 miles from Crater Lake, could that happen there?
In theory, it could, but I think that scientists are probably monitoring it and making sure that's not happened. The circumstances at Lake Nyos were a little unusual, but in theory, it could happen in any sort of volcanic lake like that, as long as it's still active.
All right, we'll have much more to talk about with Sam Keen. His book is called Caesar's Last Breath, Decoding the Secrets of the Air Around Us. Back on the Jefferson Exchange with Sam and your phone calls and emails in a minute 10. Final segment on today's Jefferson Exchange. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. What is in that breath you just took a moment ago? Well, a lot of it's secondhand breath. Somebody else breathed those same molecules from the air and just not very long ago, or perhaps back through history very long ago. Is it possible that the Caesar's last breath is in your lungs? This is the question that Sam Keen, the science writer, raises in his book called Caesar's Last Breath, Decoding the Secrets of the Air Around Us. A lot about how the Earth's atmosphere got constructed in here as well. Join us on the exchange at 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. Some of the side stories in this and any Sam Keen book can be just so much fun. There's a story in here about geologists, because obviously they're talking about volcanoes and how the Earth's atmosphere formed, but didn't realize what some of the early reactions to plate tectonic theory were.
Yeah, it's one of those theories that was absolutely hated. Everyone hated the idea of plate tectonics when it first came out because it seemed impossible that these gigantic continents could move over time like that. And the man who first promoted it basically died sort of humiliated that his ideas weren't taken seriously at all. So that was one of the theories where, it took a very concerted push and a lot of evidence for most geologists to accept it as anything near true.
Okay, from geology then back into the presence of gases in our body. You say a good bit of our body weight is gases. The number is actually fairly astounding.
Yeah, I mean, a lot of our body's water is what it is. And I think I was talking about in the context of especially Harry Truman on Mount St. Helens, who, when that eruption happened and all the hot gases poured down and poured over him, he basically disintegrated, he vaporized, turned into a gas, and then went up in the atmosphere himself. So there is a lot of, if the body gets in one of these unfortunate situations, like a volcano, it can vaporize just like any other substance.
Well, let's take a call here. We have Paul in Grants Pass on the line. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Sam Keen, the author of Caesar's Last Breath.
You know, Jeff, I'm still back on high oxygen levels in large insects. You too could have a pet tarantula the size of a Saint Bernard named Poopy.
It does cross the mind, doesn't it?
It really does.
You can take it out for walks, yeah.
That's it. Well, you've got to walk it carefully, yes, but you do walk it. So the question I have is, as we continue to change our chemical composition of the oceans, I understand that most of the oxygen that's produced on the planet these days actually comes from the phytoplankton in the oceans. What happens with that?
Yeah, that is a concern. If the circumstances in the ocean, if the situation doesn't allow those microbes to grow, or if they start to die off, that could affect the levels of oxygen in the air, too. So that could be a danger. I think a lot of us think about, learning in grade school, we think back and we think that, oh, plants are the ones that produce the oxygen in the air. And it's true that plants do release oxygen, and we get a lot of our oxygen from them. But as you said, there's a lot of microbes that contribute and that are producing oxygen as well. And we need both the plants and the microbes in order to have a stable amount of oxygen in the atmosphere. So if circumstances in the ocean changed and they started to die off, that would be very bad news for everyone on Earth.
So let's get into some of the other components of the atmosphere, because we haven't talked about nitrogen yet, which is truly a tough nut to crack. What is the deal with nitrogen?
Yeah, nitrogen is an essential ingredient in our bodies. Every little bit of DNA, every single protein in our body has nitrogen in it. And there is a lot of nitrogen in the air. It's roughly 4 out of every 5 molecules we breathe is a nitrogen molecule. Unfortunately, the nitrogen in the air is in a form that our bodies can't use. And so in the book, I talk about this sort of epic quest among scientists to take the nitrogen in the air and turn it into a useful product. And there was one man in particular, a man named Fritz Haber, a German chemist, who figured out how to take nitrogen, turn it into ammonia, which then can be turned into fertilizers. So we have, you know, we really should be thankful that Haber figured out this process. It's probably the most important chemical process that human beings have ever discovered, in that people have estimated that half the people on Earth would not be here today if not for this process that Haber discovered back in the very early 1900s.
So he came up with this science that fed billions. We had Paul Offit on a couple of months ago talking about his book, mm-hmm. Pandora's Lab, and he pointed out the other part of Fritz Haber's work.
Yeah, the other side of Fritz Haber's legacy is that he invented this great boon to humankind to make fertilizers, but shortly after that, he got involved in gas warfare during World War I. And in fact, he was the scientist who really made gas warfare the awful, awful thing, the horrendous idea that we think about today. So there was kind of this contradictory legacy he had, in that he was a great benefactor of humankind on the one hand, and then he was almost a war criminal on the other hand. And in fact, right after World War I, he won a Nobel Prize for his work, and then in the next breath, almost, the international community condemned him as a war criminal. So there's been this real tug and pull over how to think about Fritz Haber even today. It really raises some profound questions about the nature of science, scientists as villains, and what we do with the scientific powers that we have.
Yeah, his is a truly cautionary tale, and still a hard one to reconcile when you think about all the billions of people whose lives he made possible, and yet the millions of people whose lives ended prematurely because of technology he developed.
Yeah, it's just hard to reconcile those things in your head. You can go back and forth on it all day.
So one of the things that had to happen to make more nitrogen fertilizer, to be able to get nitrogen into the soil where it is needed for our food to grow, there's this issue of scaling up the process. And there's this other great story in the book about Carl Bosch and some help he got from Guinness Beer.
Yeah. So Bosch was the man basically who took Fritz Haber's ideas and made them industrially possible. So Fritz Haber was working on a lab bench, and it was an important step, maybe the most important step, but it's not the same as being able to produce it industrially. Bosch was the one who took over and made it an industrial process. But what he needed nitrogen. He needed a lot of pure nitrogen. And, you know, it's in the air. He thought that would be the best way to do it. But it's very hard to separate the nitrogen out. So he hit upon the idea of cooling it down a lot. And eventually, if you get it cold enough, the nitrogen turns into a liquid, and you can kind of siphon it off a little more easily that way. Problem was, he needed these gigantic refrigerators, very powerful refrigerators, and the only company in the world making big enough, powerful enough refrigerators at the time was actually the Guinness Brewing Company in Ireland. So he turned to them, they helped him out, they made these huge, gigantic refrigerators, and the first real fertilizers that came from this process the ones that make basically modern life possible came from the Guinness Brewing Company. So every time you think about fertilizer, you can thank the Guinness beer for making that possible.
Right. The next time you tip your glass, you know, there's a special thing to be mindful of. Yeah. Nitrous oxide, I want to move on to some other gases, and gases do get their own chapters in the book. How in God's name did someone discover nitrous oxide and its properties and then harness it?
Yeah, nitrous oxide, also known as laughing gas, is a very tiny component of the atmosphere. So you inhale a little bit of this laughing gas every time you breathe in. And people discovered it through various processes. You know, they would react to things, would give off these fumes. And scientists were very interested in fumes being given off for a long time. The second question about how they discovered the intoxicating properties that it has, the short answer is that scientists were a little foolhardy back then, and they would just expose themselves to these different gases to see what effects it has. In the book, I tell this story about a clinic that opened up to expose people to different gases to try to cure diseases like tuberculosis or, you know, mild paralysis, things like that. But the scientists involved were also very interested in exposing themselves to these gases and seeing what psychological properties they could have as well. So it was really a different method and a way to approach science back then, because they would do a lot of self-experiments as well.
So, which is why there's a fairly long list of scientists who seemed like they were on the verge of important discoveries and ended up dying suddenly.
Yeah, like I mentioned, the curse of oxygen earlier, you see a little bit of it there. You see it in the nitrous oxide chapter. And yeah, you see, unfortunately for them, their foolhardiness sometimes tipped the wrong direction every now and then.
I would have been disappointed, Sam, if you hadn't gotten to in a book about the atmosphere around us, if you didn't discuss flatulence.
Yep.
And so, yeah, no disappointment here. So who was Joseph Pujol? And in Spanish, it would be Pujol, wouldn't it?
It would be Pujol, yes, indeed. It might have been Pujol in French, but I don't know. So he was basically the a performance artist. He was on stage in the Moulin Rouge in Paris, late 1800s. And his act, to be blunt, was farting. He would inhale gases through his rectum. He would push them back out, and he would do impressions with these gases. He was very good about controlling the pitch, the length, things like that. He would do animal impressions. He would sing songs like the French national anthem with them. He was really this amazing talent, and he became the most popular artist in late 1800s Paris. And, you know, it sounds sort of lowbrow and, you know, not very bright, but he had a lot of admirers. Renoir, the painter, Ravel, the composer, Sigmund Freud, the king of the Belgians, came to see him once incognito. So a lot of highbrow people thought he was a very talented, very good performer as well. And I like that story because, you know, gas, the Gatsby pass is something we're all curious about, even if we don't admit it in public. And this is a really memorable, fun, and interesting way to explain a lot of the really great science behind that gas that we produce. It's probably the gas we think about more often than any other gas. And again, there's some really great science behind it.
It truly is, and some wonderful history, too. And honestly, I have been looking for this story for 50 years. It was one of those things I didn't Google. I didn't Google it because I didn't believe it. My sister and father told me when I was really young, and I was like, yeah, sure, a guy who farted for a living. But there we go.
Yeah. Now, not only just for a living, but he thrived on it. He was a very, very well-known, very popular artist. So,
I don't want to ask how his life ended. I'll say it was not job related, maybe. Let's move on to more family friendly public demonstration. The first air pump. What were the circumstances there?
Yeah, there was a German scientist named Otto von Guericke who developed this pump, basically, that would remove air from things. And he ended up doing what is probably the greatest scientific experiment in history, as far as I'm concerned, in terms of how dramatic it was, about how surprising it was, the great results that it brought about. What he basically did is he had this copper hemisphere, two halves of the hemisphere. He pumped all of the air out of it, and he tied a team of horses to each end of this hemisphere after he'd pumped the air out and asked the horses to try to tear this hemisphere apart. And it turned out that the air pressure around the hemisphere was so powerful that not even teams of up to 30 horses could tear this copper hemisphere apart. Even though when he hadn't pumped the air out before this, the hemisphere basically would just fall apart on its own from its own weight. So he ended up proving that air pressure is a very, very powerful force, kind of laid the grounds for steam power and a lot of the Industrial Revolution over the next few centuries.
It is an amazing experiment. It also explains when you're trying to open a hard jar at home, what's going on there. Things are really stuck from having the air pumped out.
Yeah, when you do that, it's very tough to get it out, and you sort of see this in a lot of cases. Yeah,
Sam, was there one story that was a bigger surprise to you than any other as you researched this book?
Yeah, there was one about Albert Einstein, who invented, believe it or not, a new type of refrigerator in the 1920s. He saw that there were, unfortunately, some deaths involving refrigerators, and that the gases that they used as refrigerants back then were often toxic. They would leak out. They would kill people. And Einstein decided he was going to build a better refrigerator and set out to do it. So Albert Einstein, the home appliances guru, was a pretty surprising story.
He would not have approved of avocado or Harvest Gold, I think. But it's interesting. Yeah. Einstein and a refrigerator, one of the many great stories in another Sam Keen book, Caesar's Last Breath, Decoding the Secrets of the Air Around Us. Sam, always a pleasure. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.